Welcome to our final session on interfaith dialogue, today with Reverend Liddy Barlow. Next Sunday, we start a new series with Jack Opperly called Four Women You Should Never Forget. Jack will tell the stories of Harriet Tubman, Corrie Ten Boom, Rosa Parks, and Mother Teresa. And if you've ever heard Jack Opperly speak, you know that he's an excellent storyteller. So hope to see you next Sunday. And now, our last session of Sofa Spirituality.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be back with you for our final of these four sessions. So I'm Liddy Barlow. I am without my partner in crime this weekend. Rabbi Ron Simons is in Philadelphia celebrating his son's graduation this weekend from Temple with his MBA. So we send good wishes in their direction. So as always, we'll start today with our covenant and introductions, and then we'll move into our interview for this morning. We're going to be hearing from a Zen Buddhist priest this morning, talking about how we make traditions our own. And so then we will, of course, have our time of dialogue to consider how the themes of that interview come to us in our own life. So a window into the spirituality of Zen Buddhism, a mirror to reflect on our own spiritual lives. As always, our sofa conversations are guided by our covenant. So together here in this space, we agree to be kind, to be curious, to engage without judgment, to speak with honesty, and to share the floor, making sure that everyone's voice can be part of the conversation. And to start off, to bring everyone's voice into the conversation, I'd like us to invite us to introduce ourselves to each other. And today, I'd like you to agree to that covenant. Tell us your name, how you identify, and then what is an article of clothing that has some special meaning for you?
Well, that's a trick question.
Right? So who'd like to start us off?
Bobby is fearless. We'll start up here.
Yes, I agree to follow the covenant. My name is Bobby Hartman. I use she, her. Oh, my goodness. I probably should say my wedding dress, but I don't know. A number of years ago, we took a trip. And it included Turkey, and my husband bought me my famous red leather jacket that I wear all the time, and everybody in this church knows I wear it. And I don't know, it has a special meaning because it was a special trip, and I have a special husband. So, yeah.
And speaking of,
I'm Tom Hartman. I follow the covenant. I hope he, him are my pronouns. And I have a Studebaker, 1957 Studebaker, and my favorite shirt has a Studebaker on it.
I'm Dan Paul. He and him are the pronouns. And I have a tie that's from the Children's Museum, and it's a very special tie to me.
Okay. What is it? What does it look like?
Oh, now you're...
Well, I mean, I'm just curious.
No, it has children on it, okay, in various forms. Mm-hmm. Nice.
My name is Chip Staub. I guess it's pronoun be he or him. And my probably most appreciated piece of clothing are ongoing sets of tennis shoes from walking the dog, painting here at the church, working in the yard. I always buy the same brand, and then they wear out, it keeps going on and on and on. So lots of meaning there.
Great. The perpetual tennis shoes. I like it.
I was once in a seminary to become a Catholic priest, and I wore a cassock, a black cassock with a cincture and a Roman collar. And it made me feel very secure in the world because this tells everybody what I am. I don't have to worry about my identity. My identity was pretty well set. Then I left the seminary, became a lawyer, And now a suit and a tie, an expensive watch, gives you that appearance of power. You belong to the people that are know all the levers in the world to pull and how to get things done. I felt pretty secure in that. Now I'm retired. I don't wear a tie anymore. I don't wear a suit anymore. I don't wear my expensive watch to church to show off, you know. I have a pullover that I use that makes me feel informal, but that's about the closest thing I can think of anything that replaces all these other great symbols of who I am. I don't know. Well, I do know, but I'm, you know, I know who I am. I don't need a symbol. I don't need any clothing. I mean, I do need clothing, but no specific clothing.
Appreciated.
I guess John is not into pronouns. Okay. I'm Doug Mitchell. My pronouns are he and him. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's
okay.
Right.
Oh, good. I agree to follow the covenant. And I don't want to sound corny at all. I want to sound authentic. The article of clothing that has most meaning in my life is my fraternity pin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same pin that my father-in-law wore. Mm-hmm. And I have that. And my son. But most importantly of all, when I was initiated, I wanted to actually test to see if the vows that were forthcoming would parallel in my life. And lo and behold, they have guided me in my life in synchrony with my faith.
That's great.
So that has a great deal of meaning.
This is a difficult question. And I'm trying to clean out my closets. So there are things that I don't wear much at all, but I cannot get rid of them. So I have to choose one of those, to be honest about things. And I have this pair of boots. They're Red Wing boots. They're high. They have laces. And I got them in high school. And I had to ask my dad for them because they were a little expensive. And I just really like them. They're odd. I'm sort of embarrassed to be seen in them, but I suppose the meaning is that my dad says, "You sure you really want those?" And I said, "Yes." And I convinced him of something that was against his better judgment that he went ahead and did for me. So I guess that was a win-win, but it's these pair of boots and I've trying to put them away. I put them in the trunk of the car to take them to give away, but I haven't quite done that yet. So my name is Ann Morris. I agree to follow the covenant and my pronouns are she and her.
And I'm Ted Kyle. I'm all in on the covenant, he and him. And I guess the article of clothing that has meaning in my life is my olive green hooded, fairly light jacket. And the reason it has meaning is because hooded jackets are quite useful. I probably wear it 9 months out of the year when I need a jacket. It also has meaning because hooded jackets are hard to come by. And I had one before that, and I was on a trip overseas and I left it on a bus. And I think Sarah was about to kill me because she said, "You know, it was not easy to find that. You are so careless." And she most, for which I am most thankful for, got over that and found a new hooded jacket, which I will not leave on a bus if I can help it. So Sarah, I will turn this over to you to introduce yourself and encourage people online to unmute themselves and introduce themselves.
Okay, I agree to follow the covenant. I'm Sarah Kyle, she, her. And the article of clothing that has meaning in my life is what is now an old green corduroy coat that I got when my children were young, and I've been wearing it ever since. And now they're all grown up in their 30s and I have grandchildren, but that coat is still my favorite coat, even though it's faded.
All right, thanks, Sarah. Is there anybody else online this morning?
We have several folks online. Who wants to be brave and unmute themselves and go through the questions? Just jump right in. Oh, I see Marilyn.
Do we see Marilyn?
Well, I see her unmuted.
Okay.
But she's not going yet. Anybody else? Okay. All right. Feeling shy, it's okay.
That is all right. Well, I can jump in and do mine. So I'm Liddy. I use she, her pronouns. I agree to the covenant. My article of clothing that has meaning for my life is a piece of clothing that's relatively recently come to me after the death of my grandmother this winter. I was able to take a necklace that I had actually purchased for her some years before. If you look at it, it just looks like a sort of circle with some abstract lines through it. But if you know that those lines are actually a street map and they map out the intersection in the Cleveland suburb of Lakewood where my grandparents got engaged on a street corner, the intersection of Arthur and Athens Avenues in Lakewood is where my grandfather finally popped the question. And so when I wear that, I feel close to both my grandparents and remember that very endearing part of their story. So our interview today, as you probably figured out, focuses on the liturgical vestments of Zen Buddhism and what we can learn from this Buddhist monk who lives locally. Ray Crivello is the abbot of the Pittsburgh Zen Center in Swickley. And we'll let him tell his story as we watch our video.
Welcome to Soap of Spirituality. I'm Reverend Liddy Barlow from Christian Associates of Southwest Pennsylvania, working with our partners at the JCC of Greater Pittsburgh's Center for Loving Kindness. And we are thrilled to welcome to the SOPA today, Reverend Kotoku Ray Crivello. He's the resident head priest at the Zen Center of Pittsburgh. Reverend Crivello, thank you so much for joining us on the SOPA.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great. What have you brought to talk about today?
So this, for instance, this vestment I'm wearing called a roxu. You know, this is an informal version of the full-on Buddhist robe that you see monks wear, like Bhante Pema and the Sri Lankan robes that I wear. And it was sewn like this, so you could take it with you when you work, or maybe the monks were persecuted, you know, but they always wanted to keep their robe with them. But it's made in the same style So this is we sew this ourselves when as well. Right? So when we're sewing it ourselves, we know where the fabric comes from, right? It just comes from a fabric store. We know, where all of, but we still consider this to be Buddha's robe, not ours. Mm-hmm. It belongs to the way of practice. So we treat it as if we were, as if Buddha were giving us a robe. And people, well, that's kind of religious. We do it because our past traditions are as important as what we do now. Not that we want to mimic the past, but it's the same way that we learn language, that we understand our genetic history. We have a spiritual DNA and a physical DNA. And our spiritual DNA, we have a lot to talk, say about it. So this is not meant as a kind of, these symbols here are the symbols of the two head temples in Japan. Mm-hmm. So this is about 900 years ago, it was built. This one a little later, but we go there now for our license and we meet the abbots and all of that. They don't know who we are. They don't know what we do in America. They have no clue what it's like to be a Zen priest in America, but we meet on the platform of tradition and they give us what is most useful and we take it and try to be that useful to people. So even though we understand that, we're all connected, essentially humans the same, it's through our traditions that we actually allow that to happen, that realization of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not through opinion or alone or philosophy or something like that. So we're very careful to keep our vestments, and how we give them to people. But this doesn't signify a separation. It signifies what Buddha taught his disciples, that you have to wear something, number one. And that something should be support your practice, and it shouldn't be something that other people would be afraid to look at or something like that.
Yeah,
it should be something that they fashioned it out of. When you became a Buddhist nun or a priest, and that day you got rid of everything you owned and found some rags to sew together, and that's all you wore was some rags. Mm-hmm. And so, and they couldn't tell. So Buddha said, "Look, people are asking us to find us. Let's make it uniform. Let's sew it. Let's sew all the rags together in a sort of this panels that we could wear, and we'll sew the so that we'll mimic the rice fields that we see, the way water flows through rice fields, so that it the way the practice can flow through our life. And so that's. But it's always linked to how is this helpful to anybody?" And how can this help the people around me? It sort of comes back again to not trying to show this to people as if it were, why aren't you wearing this? But I found a tradition where I could live in it and benefit myself and others, and that's why I'm keeping it close to my vest. I'm not trying to build a separate tradition. I'm trying to find a different doorway for somebody to enter. But it's everybody's doorway as far as I could tell. Yeah. So if I want to go to a church, a Catholic church or a synagogue, I went to the synagogue after the Tree of Life Massacre. I went to the synagogue to join the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. The first time I'd ever been in a synagogue. So I entered the synagogue and I joined in the service. And in joining in the service, I'm reading the scriptures. They were both in English and in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to read this. I realized that the feeling I had there was not much different than what I have in my Zen center. I could have actually kept doing that. I actually wanted to go back and do it again. But I could never join that tradition because I'm not a part of it. Mm-hmm. So I could, my job then is to make sure that tradition, if I can, is well served or supported, because that practice, that so-called difference, is important for my practice.
Right. Yeah.
It's that tradition is not there. It didn't just drop out of the sky. Mm-hmm. There's a very important reason for that tradition to be there. And so they're the holders of that tradition. Yeah. I'm a lineage holder in the Buddhist tradition, but it wouldn't be very good for Buddhist teaching if I took that and said, mine. And you're not doing it correctly. You're being a Buddhist, but you're just doing it wrong. It's not the right attitude. So how do we, so this I can say is a vestment. It means something. And I'm wearing these work clothes. It means something. But when we put on blue jeans and whatever it is you wear, it's not different. You're still dressing. You're still going out, meeting people. Your practice, your religion should not be left behind when you take this off, right? That's why we spend so much time in Zen practice trying to understand what's a commonality. What is the commonality of behavior that one person, another person can do that would lead them to waking up in their own life? Never mind what I think that is. So can people practice Buddhist meditation and not be Buddhist? Yeah, maybe more so.
Well, friends on the internet, we have so much to talk about based on this conversation with Reverend Carvello. Let's talk about what we have received and the particularities of our own traditions and how that gets passed on. Let's talk about our religious garments and what they symbolize and mean, who can wear them, what they're made from, and what they look like. And let's talk about how important it is for each of us to recognize the specificities of what's happening in other houses of worship across other traditions, and what we experience when we cross those boundaries and make those visits and experience for ourselves. So if you'd like to join in that conversation, please join us on the sofa in one of our scheduled dialogues. You can find links around this video. Kotoku, thank you so much for sharing your tradition and your wisdom with us today.
Thank you.
All right, so just another example of some of these really interesting religious leaders that we have right here in our own communities. I mean, how many of you were aware that there was a Zen center here in Greater Pittsburgh, right? So have you been out to the Zen center? Yeah, it's a cool place. It's really neat. So, all right, so let's consider some of the possible directions for our conversation today. I'll put a couple of possible directions up on the screen, and then we can see what we all feel like talking about. So we can start here. How does your faith tradition receive and transmit traditions? How do we pass things on from one generation to the next? How do we pass things to new members, new believers as they come in? And how did that process work for each of us? How did we receive the tradition that we have today? Let's pause there and we'll stay on that for a moment.
Anyone?
Yeah, Anne, I think.
Well, I'm going to say something a little negative. I remember it was my mother who told me how we do things. And if I did it wrong, she let me know. So we had to do things their way. And it was, no, we don't do things that way. And she would compare and contrast our Presbyterian traditions versus those noisy Methodists in the church behind us, or I better stop there, but it was.
Sorry, no, but I think we're all spinning that out in our heads, okay. Right? Yes, exactly.
Imagine what else I could say.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes there's this transmission by identifying the other, right? Like we do this because we are not that. Right. And I think that can be a negative thing. Right. Like, I think when it creates a class of others, but I think over history, that has also meant that defining what we are not can be a helpful way of defining who we are, especially when we're able to do that without making enemy others of those who are not. Right. What's distinctive about this particular community? Yeah, Doug.
I think some of the most persuasive approach to just about anything, including religion, would be a benefits statement.
Mm-hmm.
Something that says, well, this works for me really well.
Mm-hmm.
And here are example number one, number two, and then stop.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it is important. That's the function that it fulfills. Mm-hmm. That to me is the way to go.
Yeah. Is in naming sort of like what We can assume that people of faith are deriving some kind of meaning. Let's get specific about what that meaning is and has looked like for us.
Others?
Mm-hmm. Anne, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, I think that what we mean, or maybe what Doug means too, is Presbyterians do it decently in order, and it's our book of order, mm-hmm. our rules of how we conduct ourselves as a corporation.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I imagine, you know, in this room, there's probably a number of you who have served as deacons and elders in the Presbyterian tradition. Is that a fair assumption? Probably these are the hardcore folks who've gathered early on this rainy morning.
Has.
Right. So my hunch would be when you first came to that role, you probably didn't already have that book of order known inside out. Right. You had to learn that along the way. What do you remember about that process of growing into that role of leadership? Who taught you what you know about being in that position of leadership?
I learned very quick in Pittsburgh mm-hmm. not to do it, because Robert's Rules of Order drove the presbytery.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had to be decent and in order, or it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned a whole different set of approaches after that time.
Yeah.
I think the presbytery became much more effective as a result as well when it changed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See, that's really interesting, because for me, that connects back to what Ray was saying about how we take the tradition we've received, but it doesn't have to stay there, right? Like, we can find the ways in which that received tradition maybe is not the best cultural fit for our particular place and time. We can move on from there. So I think, yeah, if there's a rigidity, not being a Presbyterian, I tremble to make any generalizations about my observations of the Presbyterian's ways, but if there is an occasional rigidity, maybe it could be nice sometimes to take a deep breath and have a little bit more flexibility. Yeah.
Anyone else? I'll just say that I kind of agree with Anne and think about it a little bit more broadly. My answer to that question would be not so well. Even thinking broadly about the Christian faith,
yeah.
where there's this certain discomfort with tradition,
mm-hmm.
there's the connection of religious traditions or beliefs as being rooted in that othering that you mm-hmm. made a reference to, but it creeps into our life in faith to the extent that, you know, I remember growing up, every week we would, you know, say the creed as mm-hmm. a body of worshipers. This is what we believe. Mm-hmm. And the creed is something, we'll do it every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do it with communion as just sort of a, almost like, well, this is what we do when we do communion.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And not actually so much as a statement of what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that vacuum, I think you have a lot of people in the culture claiming what, not just Presbyterianism, but what Christianity is,
mm-hmm.
and that concept of what Christianity is gets really corrupted mm-hmm. so that it becomes something that I don't think Jesus would really recognize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was my soapbox.
No, it's really interesting. And I think it creates a really interesting question for us. And I'll say us, because I identify in this tradition too. What does it mean to receive and transmit tradition for reformed Christians, right? Like, because if we are rooting our particular kind of Christian identity in this sense of, you know, reformed and always reforming, then what do we do with this, you know, 2000 years of heritage that we have received? And how do we wrestle with making those necessary shifts while also still kind of holding on to something that Jesus might recognize?
One thing I've observed recently has been the difference in how the deacons and the session meetings go here mm-hmm. versus what I've been familiar with. You replace or you emphasize the positive things about mm-hmm. your traditions and can ease up on the more onerous or restrictive traditions, like we had just mentioned, following the Book of Order. But now I see a lot of emphasis on laughter, mm-hmm. joy, mm-hmm. sharing. But it's still in order. Still, people talk generally. There's a sharing of time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very positive influence that we've gone away from mm-hmm. some of the more restrictive things sure. in our past.
Yeah. Bobby.
Yeah, I'm just thinking the last time, well, let me start again. The tradition at Westminster for communion has always been the elements are laid out on the communion table, which is like three or four steps up and pretty separated mm-hmm. from the congregation. The last time we had communion, the elements were on a table down on the floor, yeah. down that with all of us. And I asked Joe, you know, this is new. Oh, my goodness. And she said, we don't need to be so far away.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really a wonderful thing because we do suffer from over formality. And I thought that was a step toward all of us being a real community. Yeah. Anyway, that was cool, I thought.
John.
I have about maybe two thoughts.
Sure.
You know, we were listening to the Zen priest, and I think a lot of us would say, well, we're going to tune that out because it's not fit with our tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the principles up there was non-judgment. Mm-hmm. And so we're making the judgment that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. But I have another vision. Sort of, I'm a poet. I kind of write poetry, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I got this idea that's going to become my next poem, but I'm not sure how I'm going to write it. But it has to do with a daisy with all the petals going around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a central part, and then there's a stem in the ground. And I'm thinking of one petal being the Reformed tradition, another petal being the synagogue tradition, another petal being the Zen tradition, mm-hmm. Buddhist tradition and all the other traditions, but they're all fed by the same root.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Presbyterian petal said, well, you're all wrong, you other ones, get out. Mm-hmm. So you're just going to have this one petal there, and then the center and the stem feeding just this one tradition, which won't really accept it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I got that image, and I'm not sure what it means, but just maybe we can learn from the other traditions, and it can enhance our spirituality, even though the form of our spirituality is different from theirs, but the substance can be bigger and more, I guess, bigger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that resonates so much with, you know, there's so many different Christian theologies of the religions, right? So Christian theologians encountering this idea of, okay, like, why are there all these different religious traditions out there? What does that mean? How do we understand what God is doing in having all of these other religious traditions? And, you know, historically, there's a couple classic ways of understanding that. There's kind of the exclusivist way where, well, all those other traditions are just wrong. You know, like Christianity is the only one. Those people must clearly be going to hell. You have then inclusivist theologies, which say that, the Holy Trinity must be at work through these other traditions, right? Karl Rahner famously said that, you know, when you see a truly good person of another faith, like, you know, an honest Muslim or a generous Buddhist, that person must be, in his terms, an anonymous Christian. Right, that really that person is actually a Christian. They just are not aware of it. And the third perspective, so you've got exclusivist, inclusivist. The third perspective, kind of typified by the writings of theologian John Hick in the I think 1970s, is this idea of pluralism. Right, that and Hick famously proposes this kind of Copernican revolution. Right, so Copernicus is like, wait a second, no, the Earth is not at the center of the universe of the solar system. The Sun is actually at the center of the universe. And so Hick's Copernican revolution of pluralism places the divine in this more kind of nebulous mystic sense at the center rather than Christianity at the center, so that then all the other religious traditions are circling the divine in their own ways. There's other still perspectives of multiple religious ends. My own theology professor at Andover Newton Theological School, now teaches at Yale Divinity School, Mark Heim, wrote a book talking about religious ends. So, you know, we talk sometimes about, well, are the Muslims going to heaven? Will the Hindus be saved? And Mark responds by saying, well, look at what their faith tradition tells them. They don't actually want to go to a Christian heaven. They're not actually looking for Christian salvation. That is not the end, the destination of their faith tradition. So does a Buddhist want to go to Christian heaven? Probably not. Does a Buddhist want to seek nirvana and release from the cycles of suffering? Absolutely, right? So what if there were multiple religious destinations, and all of us are on our own journeys towards whatever these destinations might be? So I'm not here to define which of these various perspectives of the religions is true, but I think your Daisy idea sees you in some kinship with John Hick there. Yeah, Doug.
Yeah, something that comes to my mind is we've talked a bit about how rigid Presbyterianism. And yet probably a third of the people that attend here are what they call recovering Catholics. Mm-hmm. And in their view, what they came from was far more rigid than what we have.
Yeah.
And they delight in that looseness compared to what they grew up in.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like as we use these adjectives like rigid to describe any tradition, I think it's worth digging into what we really mean by that, right? Because I mean, my experience of Presbyterians has been that rigidity is more of a kind of cultural formalism around some practices, relationships around governance, but not necessarily a rigidity around In today's contemporary Presbyterianism, it's not about like strict theological lines in the same way that it was in Calvin's day, say. Yeah. So let's look at a couple other possible avenues for conversation coming out of this conversation with Ray Crivello. So we talked a little bit about this idea of tradition, how our practices have evolved from those who shared us with us. So Ray shares his religious garment with us, and what is it about our religious garments that mark us out as followers of a particular tradition? Do you look different because of the faith that you practice? Are there ways that someone at any point could tell your tradition by what you look like? And what are some of the signs and symbols of traditions that we see, Anne?
This is coincidental. I was looking online this yesterday for some another robe or some stoles, and I thought, well, no, that one looks Roman Catholic. Or this one is a little too African-American. Mm-hmm. So I can only tell by the vestments that we wear what our tradition might be. But I don't think I could tell someone's religious background depending upon what they're wearing. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple years ago, I would have said Roman Catholics maybe do not dress up as not much. Mm-hmm. I would have noticed that, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm.
So I'll just say that I agree with Anne that I don't think you can look at someone's appearance, static appearance, and identify their tradition. But I think what you wear that should, according to my faith tradition, which I identify more broadly as Christian, be recognizable as kind, gentle, and generous. And I think that does come through in people. Mm-hmm. And if you can't recognize that, well, I'm not sure what is symbolizing your Christian faith tradition.
Yeah. Kind of a, this is your take on when Paul writes about putting on the armor of God, right? That this is the, that if a Christian's getting dressed for the day, then that Christian is putting on humility and kindness and courage and, right, exactly.
But the dress that people wear to Westminster is changing.
Mm-hmm.
When I joined in 1975, it was suits, ties, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Now some of the newer people wear shorts, wear jeans, sandals.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that formality, rigidity of what we wear is changed a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And how have you experienced that personally?
Oh, I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
As you would imagine, our contemporary service is far more laid back.
Mm-hmm.
And there the dress is very informal. But some of that informality is coming to the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a good thing.
Let me say just real quickly, I'm not sure my clothing makes a difference in the way I look. But rather than that, I think my face makes a real difference in the way I look.
Mm-hmm.
A little phrase that somebody said years ago, they'll know we are Christians by our love.
Mm-hmm.
Does it show?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Taking a note on that this morning. Thank you for
yeah. the
comment.
Mm. Sure.
We're talking about how things change. My better half is Orthodox,
mm-hmm.
and that's a religion. Around our house are icons. They're all kinds of symbols on the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
I see her tradition. We still don't eat meat on Wednesday or Fridays, whether I want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tradition that, and you go to their service, it probably looks very much the way it did 30 years ago. And they pride themselves on that. So she would argue, and I would have trouble arguing against her, that maybe these changes we're talking about are not always good. They stick to a very strict liturgy, mm-hmm. and they're congregation is thriving.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say maybe these changes that we're talking about don't always improve either our faithfulness or our experience in the church. But again, all over our house are evidences of a very different focus on Christian faith.
Yeah. I went to the zoo yesterday with my family, and there was a Mennonite family at the zoo, sort of, you know, kind of taking the same pace as ours. And like, you can't help but notice, you know, the women wearing their little, you know, head bonnets and the long dresses, and even the men having kind of a distinctive appearance. And, you know, and part of that is in intentionally marking yourself out as being different from other people, right? That we are part of a distinctive community. Our community makes particular demands on us, and the physical appearance is just a symbol of the demands of our faith and our behavior that our tradition is making of us. And you know, sometimes that's an outward appearance, like this Mennonite family. Sometimes that's an inward thing, like in the Roman Catholic tradition, you have the tradition of wearing a scapular, right? A little necklace that you wear underneath your clothes, or like the Mormon garments, right? The Mormon temple garments, right? And that part of that, wearing something that other people don't see, becomes then an inner reminder to you that there's, I need to be a little different, maybe. I need to be mindful of what my tradition has taught me. John and then Bobby.
When I studied philosophy, there was this distinction between form and substance. And the form was outward,
mm-hmm.
Traditions, acts, behaviors, and things. And the substance was more the inner essence of things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I were thinking of these questions with that in mind,
yeah.
If we think that our form or our traditions are the substance, and then there's only one, then we have to exclude all other traditions. But if we think of our tradition and the practices as forms, then there's a substance which is deeper inner, and other people can have that same substance with different form expression of it. So I don't know if that applies to this, but it seems like the substance of things, the essence of things, love, faith, not faith in just different forms and whatever, is deeper and more something we can share, like in humanity, even though we all have different forms, different colors, different traditions, different ways of dress, different ways of behavior. So I don't know if that helps. It helps me a little bit. But this is, just throw that out.
Yeah. Bobby.
Yeah, I'm convinced that we all want to be part of a community. We all want to have that around us. And I'm thinking of two experiences that I have had. I taught for 4 years in a yeshiva in Squirrel Hill, which is a pretty conservative Jewish school. And the dress there is really restricted, which, and the food, there's the whole, the Jewish dietary laws. And I wonder if there's not a comfort in that. It's like we are part of this group. This is my family, and this is an outward sign of it. Yeah. And I think you were saying that, actually.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, I think we see that in religious traditions. I think we see that in cultural traditions, right? Sure. I'm going to dress this same way that all the other fans of this particular set of musical acts dress, right? You know, I mean, yeah, we're looking for those markers of community.
Right. And also I want to be like all the other kids, but and we also, I think I've talked about this a lot. We've visited the Society of Brothers, and there is a dress there. It's not just a dress, actually, that extends their lifestyle, extends all the way to their economics, so that they don't own anything individually. Following the, I can't tell you the chapter and verse, but it's in Acts, it says they all owned everything together. but that is another way of binding oneself to one's faith mates. I don't know, you know, one's Christian brothers and sisters, or Buddhist or Jewish or whatever. So we really do need each other, and this is a way of having a relationship, even with people we don't know very well.
Yeah.
So I don't view it as a bad thing, as long as we recognize it is not necessarily dictated by God, but it does help us to be with one another in a good way.
So part of the reason why I wanted to conclude our four-part series with this video was because of the way that Ray speaks in his interview about his encounters with other religious traditions, about his visit to the synagogue after Tree of Life. And the way that I think he articulates in a really helpful way, both his sense of experience of having a genuine religious experience in somebody else's house of worship, and his clarity that that's their tradition and not mine. And even as I recognize that that is their tradition and not mine, I also feel a sense of shared responsibility to helping ensure that that tradition can exist and can flourish. And so I wonder if in our last couple minutes together, I would love to hear your experiences of experiencing the divine in a place that's not yours, and what that has been like for you.
Thank you. Firstly, I agree to the covenant.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Nolan. I appreciate it.
Sorry, I'm late. I was down at the bridge service. So I'm only 15. So a lot of my friends are also 15. Obviously, that's how that usually works. And I went to one of their bar mitzvahs when they turned 13. And it was really interesting because it's not something that I would normally do. And it was in a synagogue, and it was really cool to see the way they used language, as opposed to here where we speak our modern English. They kind of connected with God, with, I, you know, not Jesus, but it helped me connect, because that's what he would have speaked. in a way that that's how they talked. And it was really cool. Mm-hmm. I had to decipher it all because I didn't understand it. I wasn't taught it, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you have one of those prayer books where it has the Hebrew on the one side of the page and the English on the other? Is that
just Hebrew?
Just Hebrew. Just thrown in at the deep end. Yeah. What is this? Yeah. So that, I mean, it's true. Like that would have been the liturgical language that Jesus would have heard in his synagogue. It wouldn't have been his like day-to-day language. They would have spoken Aramaic, but like the same Torah passages read in the same Hebrew would have been the same Hebrew read at the time that Jesus was learning his Torah passages, right? And so there is something of that sense of amazing continuity across traditions. What else?
I just want to share one experience that several of the members of this group shared with me in 2016. We went to a church service at a denomination mm-hmm. in the Palestinian territories mm-hmm. where Christians live.
Yeah.
It was vastly different mm-hmm. from our experience in America. I think there is a tendency, a wrong tendency, to think that maybe Jesus was an American.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
The mm-hmm. whole yep. stick, you yep. know? This thing had smoke. Mm-hmm. It had icons, mm-hmm. all kinds of things. And this denomination went back to the first century.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I had this feeling, wow, are we getting it wrong? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should think about something different.
I think I've had more experiences of the sacred outside of church mm-hmm. than I've had in my own church mm-hmm. or in other traditions. Literature has always seemed to convey something deep and meaningful. Music that may not have been sacred, so to speak. So that's, I would be too uncomfortable in someone else's tradition mm-hmm. to feel that I be mm-hmm. to be receptive of the mm-hmm. sacred, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm too judgmental. Mm.
Great. John.
I don't want to say anything more about this than what I'm going to say. But I had a mystical vision of God whenever. But it I didn't see God as a Presbyterian, Catholic, Jew, Muslim. Those thoughts would have been totally irrelevant to mm-hmm. experiencing God
yeah.
and actually seeing God. But I don't want to say another word about that.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. I like it. There's a sense that all of these traditions are our best attempts to shape our human lives towards that encounter, but the reality of God is so far beyond those categories that we've created. Bob, or sorry, Tom, I'll let you have the last word before I go on.
I tell everybody that I meet that I've been married to the woman in pink beside me for 55 years. And I dated her for 65 years. When we first started dating, we were Methodists. We lived in Centerville on Route 40 toward Uniontown. And one of the highlights of that was that we got to argue with the minister as to what we believed and what we didn't believe. And we also went to Jamonville, which is the summer camp up in the mountains. And we got to meet a lot of other people who had questions, and we got to talk about it. We lived in Connecticut for a while, when I was just out of the Army. And well, the Army, I spent 4 years in Panama, and the only church we went to was the big cathedral that was in our neighborhood. And we figured we'll get some good Christmas music and Easter music, and it was disappointing. It was mostly Irving Berlin and recorded, and it was just terrible.
one of many famous Jewish composers of 20th century Christian songs. So yeah, kind of amazing. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas just like the ones I used to know. You didn't used to know them, Mr. Berlin, but go on. Right. Yes.
We moved to Pittsburgh and I was working for an architectural office, and George King was my client. George King was married to Gail King, who used to be a minister here at this church. And he was difficult to work with as a client, but he got me involved in going to Haiti. That's something we've been doing now for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. But most recently, we can't go there because it's too dangerous to be an American in Haiti. And we decided we didn't want to do it. But we sponsor children down there, and our sponsored child was 4 years old when we started, and now she's 24 or mm-hmm. something like that. And she's an adult and probably has kids of her own too. But we keep changing from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I would consider myself to be religious. But I adapt to what the situation around me is. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm a Christian, that first of all. And then I'm not the greatest Christian ever. I drink too much beer.
not totally sure that's the metric, but yeah. So, I mean, I think what I hear you saying, Tom, is this sense of that change is one of these constants across our lives, right? That all of us have been since childhood in various forms of seeking the divine, in community, in service, in exchange with others, in friendship and relationships, that this has been the trajectory of our lives, and that you can't ever boil it down to just a single thing, a single practice, but that all of us have had these experiences that have been multiple, even if we've spent our whole life in a single part of the Christian tradition. I want to just in our final moment, I do want to share with you that if you have enjoyed this series, it doesn't have to be over. SOFA Spirituality as a project does customized dialogues in particular places, organizations, houses of worship, like we've done for you. But we also do public dialogues that you can just sign up and drop in for. No need to sign up for a whole series. Just come as you like. Come when the topic strikes you as interesting. Our next public series is going to take place this June. So every Monday and Wednesday evening in June at 5:30, join us for 45 minutes of informal interfaith dialogue. We're going to have all brand new, hopefully, interviews to post with various religious leaders. So every Monday and Wednesday at 5:30, we're also on two of the Thursdays in June, doing a noon to 12:45, in case that's easier for people to do a midday. The way for you to connect with this SOPA experience is to visit the website. It's simply sopaspirituality.org. If you scroll about three quarters of the way down the page, you'll see a sign where it says to subscribe, where you can type in your name and email. If you do that, you will receive the links, the Zoom links, for each of these SOFA sessions. They'll just come to you automatically. No need to register individually. You'll just be alerted for all of those dialogues. And we would love to see you back on the SOFA. And speaking both for Rabbi Simons and for myself, it's just been a joy to be with you over these four Sundays in April. So thank you so much for your eager and open and generous participation.